everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And I tell you something, I was listening to the previous program about some of the struggles around money. And you know, as a shrink, I hear a lot of talk about money. Couples come in and they argue about money all the time. And money is one of those issues that we've all grown up with. What were your parents' attitudes towards money? Kind of an interesting thought about it. When you think back that many of us had parents who actually lived through the Depression. And then this depression mentality set out where people in the 40s were very afraid of the recurrence of the Depression. So everybody was frugal and saving and very careful. Then that went on for a generation and they passed that on to their children. And what we, the children of the people of the Depression, learned is we were told how to be careful, how not to be in debt, how, you know, you've got to save your money. And somehow, finally, a couple of generations later, the Depression mentality gave out. And what evolved was a group of paying it forward people. People who said, if you ever want to buy a house, you buy it now, you put down a little bit, and you pay it off in the future. In fact, why not buy two houses so that you can make a profit and pay it off in the future, and this will help you even more. And so then spending became the new way of life. Being in debt for $100,000, $200,000 with credit card debt seemed like the new way of life. While the value of the house raises more than 20% a year, why not pay 18% in credit? We're doing fine. So money and the concept of money, clearly that busted apart. And here we are in a form of a recession where the wealthy did not get much of the effect of the recession, but the less wealthy, the middle class, the lower classes, they suffered. And there are many people without jobs now. So money becomes the focus. Jan Denise wrote a book called Innately Good. She said, money, as they say, is a lousy means of keeping score. The baby boomers are not the first to demonstrate how to fill a life with everything money could buy, because that's what we did. But perhaps the best demonstrated how to have a winning score and still lose. And that's how it happened. You know, many people had many possessions. They had a winning score, and they were still losing. In 1922, American families gathered around a radio to hear the first daily program. The first daily program ever put on was put on in 1922. Today, the average home has a whopping 8 radios, plus televisions, computers, CD players, and iPods. And according to the U.S. Census Bureau, disposable income and personal spending more than doubled from 69 to 96. And most people believe that they want more money. They don't need more money, but they want more money. And what do they want it for? Because they want to buy things. And what do they want to buy? They want to buy things that keep them separate from each other. I want to get my own computer so I could work on my own computer. I want to get my own phone so I could work on my own phone. So this idea is that if the more money I have, the more separate I could be, becomes part of the thinking of why we want to accumulate money. Maybe we believe somewhere inside that there's a missing part of us. There's a theory about what they call the theory of lack, L-A-C-K. And it's like if you believe that you are lacking on the inside, you're always looking on the outside for something to make up for that lack. Very often the focus becomes wealth, success, money. couples who come to see me who are arguing, when they argue about money, I always see it's never about money. All the arguments you've ever had with anybody in a relationship about money wasn't about money. Why? He spent money and he was a gambler and you couldn't get enough money to buy clothing for the kids? So is this a money argument you're having? No, you're having an argument about love. You're having an argument about, do you care for each other? Do you respect each other? Do you, the gambling man, think about the woman who is struggling for every penny to feed the kids? Do you think about the kids? Do you, the woman who is trying to make ends meet, think about how restless and inadequate your husband must feel that he has to go to gamble to feel good, to feel powerful? Maybe if the two of you really thought about it, you would do other things to make each other feel secure, and he wouldn't have to go and gamble, and she wouldn't have to blame him so much. Money is an illusion. No, it's not an illusion when you can't buy food for the kids and all that stuff, of course. But for most people, and the way they do it, it's an illusion. But it's part of nature. It's no surprise that people want money. Everybody's got bills to pay. It's no surprise that money is useful. It would be irritating to pay the electric bill in corn, goats, or a kind of thing. Originally, economists argued that the fact that money is so useful, it explains why we are interested in it, because it's so useful. But you see, the problem here is that it is so useful. It substitutes for so much. It substitutes for power. I have money means I have power. I have money means I have time. Money and time go together. Listen to this one. The more money you have, the more time you have. The more disposable income you have, the more disposable time you have. What is disposable time? Time that you could spare not having to earn money or sleep after having earned the money. Time. Imagine you could take another day off. Another, you could take one more day and not work because you earned enough the other 4 days of the week as opposed to five. Time. Imagine being able to buy tickets in advance that may cost a little too much because you didn't want to wait online. Time. Yes, money buys time. But once again, my friends, the time that we need is because we are struggling so hard to make money. We're fighting so hard to make it, and I'm not saying it's wrong. Money literally looms large in our minds. We seem to give it special status. Two psychologists, Bruner and Goodman, 1947, found that children actually perceive money to be physically larger than other objects that are actually the same size. So if you showed a child a dollar bill, and you showed him a piece of paper the same size as the dollar bill looked larger. Money is perceived as bigger than almost everything else. George Fernum found that at a time of high inflation, people consistently thought that the old dollar bills were physically bigger than the new dollar bills. Of course, they were exactly the same size. The real useful value of money changes all the time. You know, number of years ago, a dollar was worth less than a dollar is worth now. Despite this, people respond to the face value of money, irrespective of its real worth. People like the form of money. People are attached to the actual form that money takes. They like the coins. They like the bills. They like all of it, but what happens when your money just becomes numbers in the bank or on the credit card statement? What happens when money gets removed from the form of money? Then where is money? What are we talking about? Hey, you know, I have a debt. I have to pay my bill. You write a check. You never see money anymore. In fact, money has kind of disappeared. Almost nothing is done in cash. Almost all shopping is done online. You know, cash doesn't exchange hands anymore. It's gone out of style. Think about it. Think about how little there is around. Money is often not acceptable as a gift. You know, if you give a gift of money to somebody, you can never give money to a friend that's a dollar bill, a $100 bill. You don't give money. You give a gift certificate. See, in place of money. There's a taboo about money buying political office, but it does, but it's not going to be dollars that do it. It's going to be favors that do it. So money is a tool and money is a drug. You know, it's a drug. It's intoxicating. That's why people feel drawn to it. So my question to you, my friends, is what is your attitude? How do you feel about it? What is the attitude of money that you had as a child? And where is that attitude now in your life? What was the money attitude that you grew up with? Money supposedly changes how we feel. It's like not just a tool, but it acts like a drug for the mind. Drugs act on the central nervous system to create mental states that do not meet some kind of function in the world in the way that food does, you know, for example. The feeling of hunger drives us to find food. We need food to survive, so hunger has a function, has an evolutionary function. We need food to survive. Part of the attraction, however, like drugs, is that it changes how we feel. But this change has no evolutionary significance. Money making you feel good does not lead to some actual benefit in the world. It just makes you feel good. You get more money, your stocks go up. It didn't do anything evolutionarily. I worked in Wall Street for a number of years. I worked for 10 years in Wall Street in a place that was a trading operation where we were very successful, quote, successful. And I was sitting there, and I was part of this trading team, and I had a good mind for it. And I remember we always won. We were like people who always won. It was a competition, but we were like, you know, a grade A team. We were a winning team. And I looked at it, and I used to ask myself at the end of the day, okay, we have more money now than we had before. What difference did it make? What happened? What does this more money mean? Did it make a change in anyone's life? You know, did anything change? Did we have any effect? No, I was working for big business, and all we were doing is accumulating numbers. The money had no significance at all. I sat there, and here I was in 1969 looking at a very successful career, and I said, what is this about? Hey, listen, there's a bunch of people out there on the lawn who are singing songs about love and handing out flowers. I'd rather be with them than hang out with the rest of you guys. So I left Wall Street. But money becomes a trap. 212-209-2900. Money is a way of keeping score. You know, we like to keep score. The more money you have, the more you, how well are you now? How well is your future? But it's a trap. My friend, it's an illusion. I am not saying that you should not strive to have a decent job and work a decent job and get a decent income. But to think that happiness is going to come with this, that's the illusion. Happiness is a state of mind. You got to settle it somewhere inside your head. If you're poor in your head, you know, you're going to really be striving for the rest of your life to make money. Let's take a couple of calls on this. 212-209-2900. We're going to take our first call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Karen. How
are
you?
Hello, Karen. Good to hear from you.
Good, thanks. It's interesting because I was never taught anything about money growing up.
Well, what did you see in your family?
Could
you turn your radio down, Karen?
Oh, sure.
All the way off.
Mm-hmm. I was taught to hold a job, make money to pay financial bills, and I guess have enough money left over to have a treat once in a while. But other than that, I wasn't really taught the value of a dollar.
Sure. Karen, how was your dad's attitude towards money?
My dad went to work every day, never called in sick, and just provided for the family.
He was a provider, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So you didn't get a chance to get very close to your dad, did you?
I was closer to my dad than my mom.
Yeah, well, what was the distance there? Why were you distant with your mom?
Tough love.
She was tougher on you.
Yes.
Tough how? She was like a she would punish you?
Yeah, she was a disciplinarian.
And she would discipline you around small things. Around going to school, around things
right.
you would say, right? Would
yes.
she punish you physically?
Yes.
Wow. I'll bet some of that was really terrible stuff, even though I know you're saying it kind of lightly. Your mother
yeah.
meted out the punishment. Your father went to work.
Right.
So you were like an orphan.
I guess I grew up quickly, yeah.
yeah. Yeah, okay, so where are you going to get an attitude that is going to teach you how grown-up humans really function when love is present? You know, where are you going to learn it? You're not going to learn it from your family, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where are you going to learn that? Where are you going to learn? The best you're going to do is take care of yourself.
And that's exactly what I've done, yes.
You've taken care of yourself.
I have two children, yes. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And you have two
mom.
Children, and you're a single mom.
Mm-hmm.
And you take care of yourself.
And my children, yes.
And you depend on nobody.
No. I try not to.
Why?
Because I just have, I guess, the mentality that it's, you know, it's my responsibility to take care of me and my family.
Of course. You know, of course, Karen. We get the feeling that it's our responsibility to take care of ourselves and our family. But you know, when you grow up in a loving environment, you get a feeling that you can depend on people and you can be there for other people too. So there is two ways to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
One way is I am my own survivor. I trust nobody. The other
way. I don't feel that way.
You feel trustworthy and trustful?
I do, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But you're going to provide for yourself. You don't trust that anybody else is going to provide for you.
I do allow it, but very sparingly.
And why? Why is that? Why sparingly?
Because I just don't feel that it's anyone else's responsibility.
How about you don't want to depend on anybody?
Okay, I don't want to depend on anybody.
Does that fit better? You don't like to depend on anybody.
No.
Yeah. So the attitude that spilled over from your family was an attitude of there wasn't very much love present, you know, and money was present, and they taught you frugality, and they taught you how to pay your bills and all that stuff. That was present.
Mm-hmm.
But love wasn't present.
Yeah, it was tough.
It was tough.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to hear it.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah, I know it is. And how does that, when you think of yourself now, being, you know, having been someone who couldn't find love early on, you think of yourself, well, I just better take care of myself, huh? And you've done a really good job for yourself.
I think so, yeah. I'm proud of myself today.
Karen, I'm proud of you, too.
Thank you.
I'm glad you made it through. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Sure. 212-209-2900. That's the kind of thing you wonder about when you grow up, you know? Mo, there are so many people I know who are saying we are providing for the kids. This is all for you. I remember one man. He would tell his child over and over again. Kid would say, Daddy, why can't you take me out? Why can't we go out? Because I have to work. This is all for you. This is because I'm going to leave this for you. I'm going to leave you this thing. This is all for you. I'm doing it all for you. It was never for you in the first place. It was for him because he wanted to stay out of the house because he couldn't stand being home. 212-209-2900, Armand DeMille. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, I'm Jeanette. How are you?
Hello, Jeanette. I'm fine.
Recently, I have graduated from college, and I moved out of my apartment where I went to school, moved back home with my mom, and then I moved out of my mom and my stepdad's apartment into my own place. About a week after I moved into my apartment, I lost my job. And for the past 8 months, I've been unemployed. I just recently got a part-time job. So it's been a very hard financial road for me.
Have you been on unemployment during this time? Or?
Yeah, I was on unemployment for the duration of that time, but I still had to ask my real dad and my boyfriend to help me make ends meet as far as taking care of my rent.
Yeah.
Because even with my unemployment, all my unemployment for the entire month still left me short considerably for my rent. So I have a huge debt from school loan, and it's extremely stressful because they call me and they badger me. And at this point, I can pay some, but it's just very stressful because when I get the money, I either am scared to spend it or I'm reluctant to pay a bill because I feel like I'm not going to be, like I could be spending that money on something better like food or transportation.
Jeanette, it's such a difficult world to live in. Because you're in this world where you're surviving and you're taking from other people at the same time. And the people are giving you money and holding you over and you feel guilty at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You combine the guilt with everything else.
Yes, it's really shameful because
Word because you feel shame. Even though there's nothing to be shamed about, you know, you are feeling shame about this. And you even feel shame when the credit card companies call you up or the school loans keeper call you up and they say, where's my money? You feel shame.
Right, because they're really aggressive and just they don't take into consideration that.
But
you know
there are two laws. That one is that if you tell somebody, a collection agency, never to call you again, they can't.
Okay.
It's a law if you state it. And that's one. The other is that there are people who negotiate debts, and they negotiate debts. I've seen this working more often. People have gotten debt negotiation, whereas if you owe money to a place and you have a person who's a debt negotiator in the middle, they negotiate the debt to a much lower amount. These are strategies that work. I have seen them work. Of course, there are hustlers who call themselves debt, you know, negotiators. I think for school loans as well, I've heard.
Well, with school loans, the law has changed recently. When I was in school, I didn't think about consolidating then, but since the economy has taken this alleged downturn, the laws have changed with the private loans that I have that basically make it impossible for me to defer it until I'm in a financial place where I can pay consistently.
Yeah.
And the law also makes it really very difficult for me to consolidate my private loans.
Yeah, it's a tough thing, Jeanette.
Yeah.
It's a tough. So living in the apartment is costing you and everybody else a lot of money. Did you move back home?
Yeah, up until very recently. No, I wasn't. I did not want to move back home.
Okay.
My family life is really stressful.
Is there something about living back at home that's very, very bad?
Well, I'm from public housing, but ever since I moved out when I was 17, I never lived in public housing. And it's actually really very hurtful to go back there. One, because I just don't like to go into the building, and there are a lot of terrible memories in that building and in my mom's apartment specifically. And two, my mother has been unemployed for 7 years, and she's extremely depressed about it, and she's not someone that I can turn to on the days where I'm extremely depressed about the fact that you know, it's really hard for me to work in the industry that I worked in. So when I try to talk to her, it kind of just goes back to her.
Yes,
so I can't really share it with her.
So she can't hear you, I hear.
Right. And then when I try to, you know, when I start working again, then I hate to say this, but sometimes she gets jealous because
sure.
She's like, well, you're young and you can work and I'm old and people just don't want to hire me. And
so here we go, Jeanette. Here's the same story as I was saying before. Yes. You have a financial trouble, but you know, Jeanette, you have a love trouble, too. The biggest thing where the mind, from what Paula said earlier today to me, which was about the mind of lack, there's a lacking mind you have. You have a mind that doesn't have love coming in your direction. You have more like a competition with your mother. Maybe your boyfriend loves you. You know, you said you have a partner. But you're really feeling this kind of absence of love and isolated in the world. I know people who are struggling very, very hard to make ends meet, but they feel the affection and love around them. And when you have that, that's one thing. But when you don't have that, everything feels like a slight. Everything feels like an insult. And I'm there for your pain. I mean, I hear the pain that you're going through. I wish your mother could put her arms around you and say, oh, Kitty, I'm so sorry for you, instead of your mom thinking about herself all the time, you know?
Right.
I wish you could go back into that house instead of facing all the abuses which I could hear you went through in that very building. You know, I wish you didn't have to go through that. Were you physically abused in that building as well?
No, my sister was.
Your sister was. So there was a horror around that as well, huh?
Mm-hmm. My sister and my mother were abused in that house. And my sister, she's very supportive of me. She doesn't live in the city. She lives out of state. And my stepfather, he works really hard to take care of the bills. But emotionally, their relationship, my mother and my stepfather, their relationship is just like, it's in dire straits. And I'm in the middle of that. And then I know that they can't financially help me anymore. Like,
it's
that's
not about
not
money.
An option.
It's not about money, Jeanette. If you had the wherewithal, and I know, I'm glad you're here, you have it with your sister, but if there was some true love in your direction, if you could feel it, which I know you may not be able to get, so here's what I'm going to suggest to you. I'm going to suggest that you do volunteer work. I want to see you not at home just looking for jobs. But while you can't do jobs, I want you to be amongst people where you could volunteer some of your time and help people. I want to see you working in places. Even if you go down to WBAI next week, we're going to be doing our fund drive. And we need people like you to answer the telephones, especially next week on Wednesday from 1 to 3 p.m. But I want to see you among people helping out and being a part of something. Because being a collaborative part of something, even if you're cleaning the streets, even if you're picking up the cups in the park, you know, no matter what you're doing, it's going to fill that spot that needs to be filled, which is a spot that says, Jeanette, you are important. You're important. You're not a nuisance. You're not just a problem. You're a valuable, beautiful being, and you deserve to have as much love as is available in this world.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'm so, so sorry that it hasn't been there for you.
Well, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, Jeanette. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, Dr. Ahmad?
Yes.
Is there a way that I can speak to someone about signing up for volunteering, or should I just call back?
Call WBAI, 212-209-2900. Let the phone ring a long while.
Okay.
And they'll tell you about the volunteer stuff, okay?
All right. Well, thank you so much for your insight.
Thanks, Jeanette. Thank you. So we're going to talk more about this when we get back from our breaks, my friend. You know, you work very, very hard to get whatever you have. And sometimes when you get what you have, it's just not enough. Because it takes more. You know, it takes more. Stay with us. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, a little relevant music. And then we'll continue with our telephone calls at 212-209-2900. We'll be right back.
Bonjour, ici Léa Kayata et vous écoutez WBAI New York 99.5 FM et sur WBAI.org. Bonjour, ici Léa Kayata et vous écoutez WBAI New York 99.5 FM et sur WBAI.org.
Marhaba. أنا ريم نصر وأنتم تستمعون إلى راديو WBAI على 99.5 FM في نيويورك. زورونا على موقعنا على الإنترنت WBAI.org. We'll be right back.
Donna Summer, of course. I always thought that was a relatively poignant song for a disco song, you know? Saying, show some of that appreciation. You know, a lot of people have problems with money. The people who have the most problems with money, believe it or not, lack the most self-control. Self-control, what an interesting concept. It's the battle between thoughts and emotions. When I see a family where the parent, the mother, explains to the children you don't have to have everything, and that if you really want something, you have to work for it, as I do know some parents to do, and they do it in a disciplined way, the kids do not get this kind of feeling of, I gotta have. So the question becomes, do you spend now or do you save for tomorrow? Many financial decisions come down to this exact problem. If you buy the dress or the sunglasses now, you don't use that money on the weekend to pay for the restaurant. How do you calculate those kind of trades or trade-offs? There are two sets of answers to the question of how we decide whether we spend or save, hoard or splurge. In the first set of answers, humans are seen as rational, logical creatures who make decisions about money by carefully weighing up the present against the future. People try to balance how useful everything is, how happy it will make you. The view of people being this logical is kind of irrational, because people are not. Self-control interacts with our spending. It's a battle between our impulsive, emotional process and our far-sighted planning one. One part of us is saying, buy it, you'll feel good. Buy it, it'll make you feel good. Get those red shoes, right? Because it'll make you feel good. Yeah, put it on your credit card. Another part is saying, no, we need that money to pay the rent. I remember a time when I was a kid, I had $5, and I had three bills to pay, Con Edison, the rent, and the electric, all which were overdue, and I had only $5, and it wasn't enough to pay even a slightest amount of any of them, so I remember I burned the $5 bill. I said, well, this makes it easy, now I have nothing. As foolish as that sounds, it was so, it was such a relief. Okay, so now this, some research has begun coming out. Increased cognitive load decreases self-control. There's something that the people who market things are well aware of. Distracted people are more likely to spend money. Most shops are filled with shiny, complicated distractions, bright colors, music, incredible offers designed to confuse you to open your wallet. The more load is on your mind, the more likely you are to spend money. If we could stimulate your mind with a bunch of things that may be totally irrelevant, the more likely you are going to be loose with your money. That's why we're going to have the pretty girl sitting on the car. You know, we've got to just distract your mind. We're going to take your mind away from the logic of it. Our supply of self-control is, believe it or not, limited. One of the studies by Burmeister and Vaz in 2003 said that they were able to weigh the amount of self-control a person can exercise is a little like the stress that you control when you're doing weightlifting. You see, self-control means you're controlling your natural reaction. And to do that a little bit, that's okay. And to do a little more is a lot okay. And then to do it a little more, that's okay. But after a while, you wear yourself down, because self-control means you're controlling the natural self. It wears you down. Sadness, any kind of sadness, makes us want to spend money. Sadness may well increase the chance that we want to spend because it makes us want a change. The more sad you are, the more likely you are to make a change, to do something. Disgust makes you want to get rid of everything. when we're disgusted, we want to rid ourselves of the things we have, and so we tend to get rid of what even may be useful. When you walk around with this general feeling of malaise, anxiety makes us want to reduce uncertainty. You know, when we get anxious, we want to kind of secure things. Now, this is where the salespeople can go tap on people who are nervous. The best person for a salesperson is a nervous person. See, they want to see a nervous person or a sad person. They're likely to make sales to these two people. To the sad person, your appeal is this is going to make you feel good. To the nervous person, this is going to make you feel secure. Here are some of the best ways to make decisions about money. Self-imposed limits. Dan Ariely, who's a good researcher, suggested that self-imposed limits can help to increase self-control. You put a preset limit on what you could spend. It would be interesting if computers now had spending limits per day. You know what I mean? Because people are doing shopping online. So if everybody did something through PayPal, PayPal might have this kind of, okay, you've hit your limit today. You've spent $100. That's all you could spend. You know those programs you see on television where they're selling jewelry and they're selling things and they have this ongoing shows? Yeah, QVC kind of things and telemarketing. How do they survive? Because there are people there whose homes are filled with boxes of unnecessary things. Because in a way, in their exchange between themselves and the TV audience, they have formed a family. And so what they do is they buy things and they say, okay, you and me, QVC. You know, that's it. I am now going to buy this. I'm going to buy, oh, that knife that cleans the toilet as well. I'm going to get that. I have to get that, you know. No, that thing that carves apples. The apple peeler, you know. Wham. ShamWow, right. It's going to do everything. So one thing is to self-impose limits of how much you can spend. Second thing is cooling off periods. This is such a discipline that it's beautiful. Take time to decide about a purchase, especially anything expensive. Not just a few minutes, more like a few hours or days. Sadness makes us likely to just end the whole thing by buying something on the spot. Anxiety makes us also buy things because we want to kind of do away with the nervousness of it. But there is a great thing about a cooling off period, kind of like I wish that gun control, you know, the way they have gun control. The way they have gun control is if you buy a license, you can't get a gun right away. You have to buy a license and you have to wait. Well, there's an idea, but it's a theory, right? But that same idea, you can't buy it solidly unless we call you back tomorrow and ask you if you want it. Now, I'll make you bet if some company put limits on this, like on, you know, if on QVC, if they said to you, okay, you want it, you've got it, but we're going to call you back tomorrow. I heard there's a Scandinavian country. There's one Scandinavian country where you never renew, you have to renew your marriage license every couple of years. And the way you renew your marriage license is you drop a postcard in the mailbox. And you send it on, we want to renew, and you sign it. And if you don't, you're unmarried. Right? What a nice idea. Your commitment is either stated every 2 years or it's not. I'm not sure about that. So cooling off periods are very good. Monitor your self-control. The fact that self-control seems to run down. Think about it as a muscle you've built. Every time you don't spend the money, if you're a compulsive spender or if you're somebody who spends a little too much, congratulate yourself. But now here's the other side of it. What if you're miserable and you never spend anything? And if you're a hoarder and you've just saved everything, save, and you've deprived yourself of everything, that's the other side of it. Money, people's attitude towards money is the same as their attitude towards love. What if you save all your love and you put it all away and you say, no, 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 I'm not going to share this with anybody? Or what if you put it out all over the place and you spend it every way you can with everybody you meet? Attitudes are very, very similar. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We're talking about attitude towards money. I want to make mention of Jan Denise's book, Innately Good, which is basically talking about dispelling the myth that you're not good. And when I think about somebody like Jeanette, who just called us, who feels like a scourge, you know, she feels like there's something wrong with her because she is living on the world right now and she feels shame for it. You know, we're all in it together. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. This is Armand DeMille. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. My name is Vicky. I recently just went bankrupt.
Ah, hi, Vicky.
Hi. How are you?
You declared bankruptcy.
Yes.
Okay. Did you, you know, you said you went bankrupt. So I want to understand. You made a decision, right? At some point you said no more, and you said, that's it, I throw up my hands?
Well, I had to go to the court and declare bankruptcy.
Tell me about it, Vicky, because I could hear the pain behind it.
Excuse me?
I could hear your pain behind it, so tell me about the experience.
Yes, it's very painful. I feel like a failure because I went back. I've always paid my bills on time and always made sure everything was done on time, but now I got into debt with credit cards, and I helped out my daughter. She was very ill. And I helped her out. She was in the hospital, so I helped her out with medical bills and doctor bills. And I just got myself into really bad debt, and I just couldn't get out of it.
And so you got into mostly credit card debt?
Yes.
It was mostly credit card debt. And now, did you try to negotiate that debt? Or did you just say either pay it or don't pay it?
Yeah, it was either pay it or don't pay it.
Okay, so you didn't try to negotiate it. So let me ask you something about this. When you went to the courts and you said, I cannot pay, they did not declare you bankrupt. You declared yourself. You said, I am bankrupt.
Right. I had to retain an attorney, and we went to the court. And you
said, no more. I can't handle it. That's it. I throw up my hands, right?
Yeah.
Now, Vicky,
I'm so afraid that I don't want to get back into that again. I don't think I'm going to be able to have any more credit cards or anything.
You mean you could? You're afraid of yourself because you think you could do this all over again.
Yes.
So,
even though I've been on a really tight budget because you can't use the credit cards for months on end. So I haven't used any credit cards since February, and I got myself on a good budget, but it's horrible. I have no extra money, and I'm miserable.
You didn't have any extra money before either.
No,
you
I
just,
didn't.
You were just paying it
no,
forward.
I didn't.
You don't have any extra of the other people's money anymore.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Okay, now, Vicky, you're very brave to have done this, because declaring bankruptcy is some of the greatest statement you could make about yourself. You could say, that's it, I can't go any further. I'm sorry, you guys, I used up your money, but I'm sorry about that, but I am going to say that's it for me. And that if for the time being you're going to penalize me by having me restricted on spending, it makes all the sense in the world. But Vicky, you sound like you feel bad about it.
I do. I feel like a failure.
It has nothing to do with failure. It's actually a sign of success. The success is that you got yourself out of this. Instead of struggling every minute and trying to, you know, beat every little thing, you know, that's a very brave thing to do, to stand up and say no more. I've known quite a few people who have been bankrupt, and they've just said, that's it, I can't do it anymore. And when they make that statement, they move on from there.
I think I went in the reverse from the way I was taught and brought up. I went in reverse for my children. I try to, you know, give them what they wanted and do what they wanted. I guess I spoiled them a lot.
Well, what you were doing was substituting money for love. You see, your kids were lacking. They probably didn't have a father available.
No, their father passed away, and I felt really bad.
So you were trying to make up for it. So, again, instead of the love, right, you're trying to supply them with things. And while doing that, you're putting yourself into debt. It just makes sense. But all right, Vicky, this one's over, you know. We're starting on the next one. You know, and I need your spirit back. I need it because there are a bunch of people out there. There are a bunch of people who need your help, who need your service. They need your wisdom. So are you working again?
I'm in the process of getting a new job.
Good for you.
It's really hard, but I'm doing what I can.
Good for you, Vicky. And if you get a chance, get down to volunteer down at WBAI when we have our fun drive. Answer some of those phones. You know, the people down there are pretty decent, and I think you'll feel better being around good folks, and nobody's going to judge you down there for being bankrupt. In fact, I think they give awards at WBAI to people who are bankrupt.
Okay.
Thanks for
calling
in.
You made me feel better.
Thank you, Vicky. Thanks for calling in.
Have a good day.
Thank you. 212-209-2900. There should be a pin. You know what I mean? A pin that says, that's it, no more. It says no more and says chapter 11 on it. 212-209-2900, Armand DeMille. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
Hi, Armand. This
Hi
is
there.
Russ from Hudson Valley in Orange County. And,
hey, Russ.
I really appreciate your show. You do a great job.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm wondering if you could address the feelings that you get when you encounter someone such as a neighbor who invites you over and they've got a substantial amount of more material things and a much bigger house, and what happens when you become judgmental in a case like that? And conversely, when you...
You become judgmental
of them?
Well,
you become judgmental and become analytical, get some feelings of inadequacy sometimes. And then conversely, what happens is that when you get together with people who don't have the same means as yourself, feeling a little bit guilty or a little bit uncomfortable about you know, your own personal status.
Wow, Russ, you are so aware of yourself. You have such an amazing amount of internal insight. How nice.
Thank you.
How did you do this? How did you develop this level of being able to understand yourself? Because most people would go over to somebody's house who has more than them, and they just judge them and put them down. You know it's coming from a place of lack inside of you. You know that it's coming from sense of inadequacy.
Right.
So that's terrific. I mean, this means you never get caught in the trap.
You've got the lesson to teach. Right. I'd like not to, but what happens is in the you know, one of the things that you really want to be able to throw the shackles off of is being judgmental and being able to accept people for whom and what they are. But I think it's a fairly common feeling among a lot of people when they get together with people who have much more than themselves or have much less than themselves.
Sure. It's common to try to judge them because you're coming from a sense of inadequacy. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so then what you do is you become analytical. You say, look at his relationship with his wife. That's not so good, so there. So he's not so happy.
Right.
You know what I mean? But you're right. There is a kind of a separateness that I wish we could establish where you could say to yourself, I am my own being. He is his own being. He's got more than I do, and I wish I had some of the things he has. But he's just a different being. Not a wrong being, not a bad being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Rumi said this thing. He said, Rumi the poet, he said, out beyond all places of wrongdoings and right doings, there is a field. I'll meet you there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that's kind of what you're talking about.
Mm.
You could find your meeting place. But I tell you, Russ, I'd rather have you come over to my house anytime. Because whether I've got more than you or less than you, at least you're self-aware. And that, to me, is one of the most valuable things you could have. You know, personal insight, to me, is worth millions. Because it's the people who don't have it, the ones who suffer the most.
Well, thanks for the feedback, Armand, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Russ.
Right. Bye-bye.
Armand DeMille here. Time for one more call. We're going to take it because we're going to be short of calls soon. 212-209-2900. Hi, you're on the air.
Well, I'm on.
Hello there. Hi. Thank you. Could make it in.
Yeah, that's good. You know, this money topic is really huge. Eckhart Tolle says, you know, those who live by the flesh, by form, by material things, there's never a happy ending, only dead bodies.
Yeah, well said.
That is so great.
Well said. What's your name? What's
my name is Tim.
Tim?
I've called before.
Yeah, I know you, Tim.
Yeah, and I want to say something about this pledge drive, this fund drive. It always, you know, it gets me all upset, and I just go into a depression when you guys aren't on and whatnot. This time I'm going to do something a little different. I'm going to really make a pledge. I'm going to send some money in. Then I'm going to do some service by answering the phones down
there.
Oh,
Tim, and I think thank you so much.
We'll make it a little faster, right?
Right. Thank you so much. Yes.
So
yes.
Anyway,
I regret when I'm not on during those times, but they need to put on the programs.
You're a little hooked on your program then, huh?
What?
You're a little hooked on your program.
I love
our
program. It's not my program.
Yeah.
It's ours.
Well, I try to do this. Let me put it this way. The random act of kindness. That means don't be looking for old ladies to cross the street or anything. It's got to be random, you know, just a spur of the moment. And you can't talk about it.
Nice,
so anyway,
except for you telling us all about it, Tim, on the air.
The other thing is, you know, I noticed that we have a saying in the programs, 12-step programs, that, you know, don't judge your insides by somebody else's outsides. That's the important thing, the insides. But I want to tell you, I'm all screwed up with money, and I'm a clutterer, and I want to do some things because it's hard to function. And I have an addictive personality, but right now the only thing I'm on is coffee. But that's bad enough.
Tim, we're out of time.
All right. See ya. Thank you.
I want to thank you so much for calling in. You sound like a good spirit. Thanks for bringing us the wisdom of Eckhart Tolle. My friends, I will be back with you on Tuesday. No? Oh, yes, I will. Tuesday at 1 p.m. And then on Wednesday, I'm going to be doing part of the fund drive. And I'm going to be making a special offer for all of you. Make sure you tune in. Back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m., my friends.
And thank you so much. Armand DeMille with The Positive Mind back here, as he said, on Tuesday at 1 p.m. right here on a listener-sponsored commercial-free community radio WBAI at 99.5 FM and also online at WBAI.org. And we look forward to all of you coming in and coming down here, spending time with us, helping answer phones, and all, particularly the callers that were on the line today, those that Armand had invited down to the radio station to help answer phones. We look forward to seeing you next week, and I'm going to make a special effort to look you up on Wednesday when Armand is on the air and welcome you to radio station WBAI. Don't worry, someone else will welcome you before then, but I want to make that special effort. All right, coming up next at 2 p.m., Perspective with Luis Reyes Rivera. Do stay tuned.
Promo. We're between shows.
Well, which one do you want?
Play anything. We don't want dead air.
Remember, WBAI's fall membership drive runs from October 14th through November 7th right here at 120 Wall Street, 10th floor. To become a volunteer to answer phones during the drive, call Vera in advance at 212-209-2826 so your name can be entered in the security computer. See you during the drive.
That's the promo you played?
I thought it was good.
Yeah, it was. And you can dance to it.
Yeah.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country. A media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
On October 14th, The Breck Forum and Verso Books welcomes Slavoj Žižek. Slavoj Žižek, the author of over 50 books and featured in the film Examine Life, transverses the field of psychoanalysis, cinematic studies, and radical left politics. His latest book, First Time Tragedy, Second Time False, is a unique meditation on the global economic crisis. Slavoj Žižek will be speaking October 14th, 7 p.m. at the Cooper Union, 7 East 7th Street. For tickets and more information, contact the Breck Forum at 212-242-4201. That's 212-242-4201. Or online at www.breckforum.org.
Play a promo. We're between shows.
Well, which one do you want?
Play anything. We don't want dead air.
Remember, WBAI's fall membership drive runs from October 14th through November 7th right here at 120 Wall Street, 10th floor. To become a volunteer to answer phones during the drive, call Vera in advance.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.